Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host Alfred Addisk will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report for the second and third segment of the program today. And, of course, due to James's location, Japan, the program has to be recorded in the evening. So the program with Alfred and James was recorded last evening to be played for today. So thank you for joining us. It's Thursday, January 8th, 2015. Let's go ahead and get right into the market report today. So you folks are stuck with me for 20 minutes. So gold today, 1208, down 380. Still very strong at these numbers. Just it's down a few dollars today, a few dollars yesterday. But considering we're hitting another, closer to 93 earlier in the day for the U.S. dollar. So really, in with the markets, gold is having its own showing, even though it's down a few dollars. So again, gold 1208, silver's down 21 at 1642. I don't know what's wrong with these reports today. It shows both, platinum is down $4. At 1223, along with palladium, $795. Not a lot of change, basically flat on the day there. USDX today, 0.32 to the upside at 92.33. Crude oil today, up 0.07 at 48.72. 48.72, and the paper markets today, you had the Dow surge 322 points. So, again, we're just 100 points shy of that 18,000 level. All three major indexes now are positive. And, of course, they're cheering this all due to stabilizing oil prices. So, of course, Wall Street will be giddy. They'll be waiting for the report for tomorrow, but you have the Dow up 323 points, up almost 2%, both the Dow and the NASDAQ, at 17,907. The NASDAQ up 85 at 4736. The S&P up 36 at 2062. And, of course, the 10-year yield, which is expected to move up with a big jump in the market today, 0.06, a 2.2%. Not a big jump there, but some of that money flowed out of there and into the paper markets. And so that's pretty much it there. You know, the release of the Fed minutes earlier this week, you know, it's interpreted as a non-event. But look at the follow-through in stocks yesterday and today. I mean, yes, it was a non-event. There wasn't anything in there that no one had, you know, expected to read or interpret. And everything was as is, but it was a good sign. And again, it supposedly because of the stabilization of oil, we've seen this big follow through the past couple of days. But we're certainly seeing the strength in the paper markets. And as I mentioned before, I think gold is performing stronger than I was really expecting with these other huge numbers. So there is something in the system that gold is saying, you know, there's more going on, and we'll see how it plays out. But so I like what I see with gold. And we had a little bit of liquidation, again, both yesterday and today. But again, the price has remained fairly stable. You have 1220 as the near-term resistance for the closing price of gold. And, of course, if it would close above that, we could get some further gains with gold looking to about 1250. And, you know, we had the dollar rise again to a nine-year peak. And but you have to remember, making dollar-denominated gold more expensive for holders of other currencies. We're going to wait. The markets, of course, they probably already have the information, or they've already received the information for the U.S. payroll data coming out tomorrow. So, you know, we could see, you know, if that is a good number, which I can't expect it to be anything but a good number, you know, you'll see another couple hundred point increase in the paper markets. Leaving the markets here, you have the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. They're in the middle of a decision that's going to raise taxes for close to 90% of Americans. Now, this the FCC, they're considering to reclassify broadband as a telecommunications service. And that way, Washington could trigger new taxes and fees at the state and local level. Did you ever look at, when you had your hard lines, I know few people have hard lines anymore, but look at your phone bills. I mean, look at all those taxes and fees they have on there. And, of course, now if they are able to do this to the broadband, you'll be paying even more. Even last year, this is a follow-through from what Obama wanted. He wanted the internet to be treated as a public utility, and now you have the FCC that they're trying to make the internet a public utility. And this goes back, and it falls under all these Communications Act way back to 1934, and there's big consequences for the taxpayers. You could face, again, as I mentioned, state and local taxes and fees. According to the Progressive Policy Institute, it would total $15 billion annually. On average, consumers would pay an additional $67 for landline, $72 for mobile broadband each year. And, of course, you know, the critics of this would reduce investment in infrastructure. Now, it's really amazing. We've seen the growth in this industry, in the telecommunication industry, but they have invested more than $1.2 trillion on broadband infrastructure only since 1996 for 19 years. And maybe $1.2 trillion isn't a lot for, you know, 19 years, but it certainly does seem like an awful lot. And, of course, you know, you start changing the regulations and so forth, and, of course, this is just going to change it to making it more difficult. You actually have about 87% of Americans that do have access to broadband. And you would think it'd be kind of foolish for the government to discourage the significant investment requirement to maintain, expand, and improve by subjecting this broadband to the way back of the 1930s regulation. But and again, and what I really wanted to go on is see is, you know, with higher taxes, you know, in a period when you have individuals, we have families, you have with less disposable income. And you would think that higher taxes, it would be bad for the economy. But since Obama's been in office for 6 years, you've had more than 20 tax increases that have been signed into law. And but, you know, hey, what does that matter? The American taxpayer doesn't really care. You know, they, you know, are just reducing in other ways, and they're happy because their gasoline prices are going lower. So, hey, they can afford more taxes. So let's just change it around, give them a little few cents in return here so the government can take back double that. So, I mean, it really is kind of, it just makes you scratch your head and ponder, you know. Here's some other interesting information. America has lost 1 million corporations since their height during the Reagan era. And in part, they've been driven out of business by industrialized world's highest corporate tax rate. And this is a new report coming out from the Tax Foundation. And this is just issued research that revealed that the number of traditional C corporation has fallen to a historically low level and wiped out the corporate tax base, resulting in the federal government relying much more on the individual income taxes to fund their growth. There is now more net businesses income tax under the individual income tax system than the traditional corporate tax code, a trend that does not appear to be stopping anytime soon, this report continues. Another interesting fact, it said that corporate closings have recently picked up steam, and now 60,000 a year are shut down. Now, I don't know, you know, how many are created, but I mean, I think 60,000 a year that are being shut down for corporations seems to be like a fairly significant number. And as you're having, again, more taxes, less income, you know, taxpayers are getting strapped. There was a new policy signed by Obama. You know, he's patting himself on the back, saying that he's turned around the housing slump with home sales. Construction is up. Foreclosures are at the lowest level since 2006. And so now he's issuing or announcing a new step, and this is trimming mortgage insurance premiums so people can, so it'll help people buy their first home. So let's, you know, let's get the, you know, let's drop their down payments to 3%. Let's cut their cost in mortgage insurance premiums. And, you know, that way it should help everyone buy those new homes. And they said the cut would save the average home buyer about $900 a year. It would help 800,000 who refinance their mortgage also save money. And it will entice about 250,000 people to buy homes over the next 3 years. And on this rate cut, it's supposed to take effect by the end of this month. And it is no coincidence that this new policy begins at the same time that there are concerns about the housing market. In the latest issue of the American Survival, I had a list in there. It was a short list, but a list of concerns that could actually affect the housing industry for 2015. And we've reported on this for a year or so. And the big concern with a lot of folks out there is the institutional investor that has played a very important part, a huge role, as they purchased hundreds of thousands of homes to rent out. And if they begin to cash out, housing prices could begin to fall, and you're going to have a glut of homes in the market. So here's the government helping new home buyers get in the market. So, you know, perhaps this is, you know, there is nothing by coincidence. The NAR, the National Association of Realtors, reported that institutional buyers accounted for 15% of all sales in October, down from 20% in January. From January 2012 to August 2014, 200,000 purchases were made by institutional investors. Then those who made purchases in 2012 could walk away with 38 to 43% if they sold now. I think we touched on this on the program also last week. With the stronger dollar, you have the foreign investors who have also helped in the recovery in the housing. They could also begin to walk away. You have Chinese buyers that were strong buyers, but Europe and Russia with the problems, they're beginning to lag. Those buyers are beginning to back off. Incomes, we know incomes have failed to keep up with prices, with home prices, and even with lending standards that have eased. You know, perhaps I don't believe it is strong enough to compensate for drops in housing, as previously mentioned. Then you have the higher mortgage rates, and if you have the housing market that becomes stagnant this year, 2015, I keep saying next year, but next year is already here, you could have some problem. And then let's not forget all these illegal aliens that have come into this country that will be also looking for housing. We have a few minutes left before we go into the break, and I thought I would take a few minutes today to explain briefly why $20 gold pieces are a great way to buy gold. You hear a lot of negative comments out there, and I truly do believe there are no bad coins out there. It's just how you buy them and what you expect them to do. So I think $20 gold pieces, pre-1933 gold coins, is a great way to buy gold. You know, in Mint State 61, if you don't get into the rare dates or the special dates, you want to buy the common dates. And even though they're called common dates, I mean, these beautiful U.S. gold coins, they're actually very scarce. I mean, there were millions of these coins that were originally minted. Almost all were heavily used in circulation during the 1800s and early 1900s. You only have a fraction of these coins that truly survive in mint state condition. And I'm going to have some numbers here. You also hear, let me see, did I keep those numbers? For Mint State 61 $20 gold pieces, the total certified population for NGC and PCGS as of late last year is only 195,800 coins. 195, almost 196,000 coins. That's not a lot. That's all. And so you get a scarcity that can mean higher premiums during periods of increased demand. And unlike most forms of gold bullion, they are exempt from broker reporting requirements. They offer all the benefits of gold bullion, plus extra benefits like limited supply, demand, complete financial privacy, and extra premium potential because of the scarcity. Are these true rare coins? I wouldn't classify these as rare coins, but they're certainly in a very limited supply of coin in a Mint State 61. Now, your Mint State 62s and Mint State 63 $20 Liberties, there's actually more of them to be certified from NGC and PCGS, and that is mainly because of the cost involved in going from a brilliant uncirculated to a Mint State 61. They just don't seem to certify a whole lot of those coins. So that's why you see a limited supply. But then again, a lot of these were certainly used in circulation. With a Mint State coin, you at least have the opportunity of taking advantage of the increased premium and trade for multiple ounces of gold. And we'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow because we're going into a break. We're going to continue the special Mint State 61 $20 Liberty gold piece certified by NGC or PCGS. Give us a call, 1-800-375-4188.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Does the cost and risk of conventional healthcare concern you? Wouldn't you prefer inexpensive solutions to health problems rather than disease management? If so, tune into Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com, CorbettReport.com. James Corbett's been living and working in Japan for a decade now, 11 years, I think. He started the Corbett Report as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. We get to talk to James almost every week, and always a pleasure for me. It's always interesting. You learn something, and I'm always pretty much amazed. I'm waiting to see if we have questions. I think James admitted we had a question once a few weeks ago that he wasn't necessarily able to answer, you know, extensively, but that would be one out of maybe 50. Maybe I've posed 50 questions. Maybe one he couldn't answer extensively. We'll see if I have any tonight. Hello, James. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Happy New Year, Alfred. How are you?
Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to you. How are things going in Japan with Abenomics?
Well, politically, economically, in other ways, probably not so well. But at least me and my family are happy, and that's the first part of the equation. And yes, unfortunately, I think this is going to be probably a pretty trying year for Japan overall in terms of the economic situation, and the political situation is going to deteriorate from here. So at any rate, I have a front row seat to whatever kind of fireworks are going to be taking place here, and probably a front row seat to what's going to be coming down the line for a lot of the Americans in the crowd as well.
And when you say coming down the Americans, do you think we're in the same boat and we will independently come to the same fate as Japan? Or are you suggesting that Japan is going to trigger things, its troubles will eventually trigger things here in the United States, and as a consequence, at least in part of Japan, we may suffer some problems here in the USA.
Well, I think their fates are linked in a lot of different ways. And I mean, one very simple and obvious way in which they're linked is the fact that the U.S. dollar / Japanese yen exchange rate, when you chart that against the Nikkei stock index here in Japan, I mean, it's in lockstep. Every time the yen is devalued, the stock index here goes up. So, yay. They've managed, I think, it's something like a 26% rise in the Nikkei since early 2 years ago, no, 2013, and that's on the back of something like a 22% devaluation of the currency, or maybe that's the other way around. But at any rate, it is in lockstep, and when you plot them together, it's quite obvious that just the more that the yen is devalued, the more the stock market goes up. And in a lot of ways, that's similar to what we've been seeing taking place in the American economy, not so much the devaluation of the dollar against other currencies, but just the sort of pumping up of the quantitative easing and the flooding into the bank's pockets of various reserve funds, which has allowed them to speculate more in derivatives and get more involved in equities markets, which, of course, has propped up the U.S. markets for the last few years. And, of course, we've seen the record high after record high on the S&P and the Dow. And, again, I'm very skeptical that that will be maintained even throughout this year. I think that it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to be able to maintain that, especially as they start to talk about raising interest rates again. I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see what actually eventuates from that, but I can't imagine them actually successfully raising interest rates without having knock-on effects in the bond and stock markets.
Yeah. You know, I've got an article. I'm looking at an article that was written by Tyler Durden at ZeroHedge.com, and it's entitled Seven Reasons to be Fearful. Right? He has seven items to watch out for that we're seeing trouble. And the first three items are, one, a strong dollar. He says a strong dollar is in the best interest of the United States until it isn't. Then he goes on and elaborates on that a little bit. Item number two, emerging markets. He said, watch out for emerging markets, but here's why. For the developing world, persistent dollar strengthening invites a great deal of instability. And what we're seeing here, his first item, is a strong dollar. His second item is a consequence of strong dollars. And his third item of the seven to be feared are cheap oil, which again is at least in part due to the rising, the deflation of the dollar and its rising value. The point I'm trying to make, he's picking out three of his seven items to be fearful. Go to the idea that we are seeing deflation in the dollar and that its purchasing power is growing. Is that something we should fear? Most people would sit back and say, well, strong dollar, it's got to be good. Is it?
In a time in which the U.S. was the global engine behind global economic growth, I think that the strong dollar it certainly worked out for the American population at the end of the day. But we are no longer in such a world, and I think that's going to be made more and more explicit in the coming years. Probably, by this year, I think we'll start to really see some of these effects. For example, talking about the way that the strong dollar can affect emerging markets, we saw that back, I want to say last year, but I guess 2 years ago, back in 2013, where we saw the sudden devaluation of the rupee as a result of the unwinding of the quantitative easing. We started to see some of that money flowing out of the emerging markets and back into the U.S. economy, and of course that brought down what was happening in India and other places at the time. So we saw a big knock-on effect on the rupee, which slowed down Indian economic growth. And obviously what we're seeing right now, of course, is affecting the Russian ruble, which is plummeting right now against the U.S. dollar. And that's cutting into the Russian economy, which we're starting to see the depletion of Russian reserves in a pitch to try to maintain something like a not a ruble pegged to the dollar, but at least some sort of stability in that exchange. Yeah. But of course, that's going to deplete the Russian reserves pretty quickly as well. So I think all of this plays into, including the cheap oil, it all plays into that decoupling of the global system from the U.S. Economic driver of growth that we saw in decades past. And what we're seeing, again, is the emergence of this other part of the global economy. Now the fastest growing part, the emerging markets, increasingly being left out of the American loop, economically speaking. And that can be a bad thing, I suppose, but it can also be a good thing, I suppose, depending on which way you're looking at it. And ultimately what it means is that these emerging markets are going to be more and more relying on each other than relying on American trade to fuel their emergence from the economic doldrums. And that's probably, in the end of the day, that's not a good thing for the American population, which, again, is seeing itself decoupled from this system. So, and as that article you're referring to points out, I mean, dollar appreciation, the devaluation, the deflation in the dollar is actually going to hurt the American economy in terms of its exports. I mean, to the extent that there is still American-made products that there are to be exported, that is going to cut into the comparative price advantage in various countries. So that, I mean, for example, here in Japan, just as one example, I mean, the price of an Apple iPhone continues to go up here because, of course, the yen is continuing to be devalued, so Apple needs to ramp up their rates. Or McDonald's recently raised their hamburger rates. Not that that affects me or my family, but still, it's just another sign of what's happening globally. So all of this cuts into American manufacturers and American corporations' interests abroad.
I've heard a couple of reports that calculate the problem with the emerging markets is that they were hot. They had several years when things were really doing well for them. And during that period of time, entrepreneurs, corporations in the emerging markets borrowed, they went into debt in order to invest and try to catch that wave and, get rich. But the problem for many of them is that they borrowed dollars. All right? And they borrowed dollars before we saw any sign of deflation. And it was an intelligent bet when they borrowed dollars because we've had inflation. You could count on it. It's the reason why people, it's a primary reason why people buy mortgages or buy homes in this country. They're assured that when they take out the mortgage for 20 years, 30 years, you're going to be able to pay off that debt with cheaper dollars thanks to the persistent inflation we've had in this country for most of my lifetime. All right? And then all of a sudden, we go from inflation to deflation, at least on the international markets. And as a result, these people had borrowed in the emerging markets. Now they're paying off not in cheaper dollars, which has been a sure bet for most of my lifetime. They're paying off in more expensive dollars, and this predisposes them to bankrupt. They can't make their payment. They tend to default on their debt, and this is perhaps the danger of the strengthening dollar, the deflating dollar on the emerging markets.
That is absolutely, yes, one of the dangers. And I think you pointed that out very, very succinctly there, because this is really analogous to the yen carry trade that's gone on for quite a long time, where people have bet on the 0% rates or very close to it that have been available in Japan for borrowing yen, basically for no cost. So people will borrow in yen and then use that to speculate and then, of course, unwind that back out of the yen. So that's been the main driver of the U.S. dollar-Japanese yen exchange for a long time. But in recent years, when we've seen the Fed lowering its interest rates down to very, very low levels, we've seen basically investors looking for anywhere that they can try to get actual return on their investments, obviously not in U.S. Treasuries. So they've been borrowing out of the dollar and, as you say, speculating in emerging markets, which have been red hot, especially last decade. And so, again, as we see that starting to unwind because of the deflation of the dollar, we're going to see that hurting the emerging markets. And, of course, the people who were speculating in those markets, the longer they hold in those markets, the more they're going to be hurt by this. So this is a very unstable time, and it's going to involve a lot of unwinding. And it's, I think, also, I mean, another factor in all of this, of course, is the deflation that we're seeing across the commodities markets board right now, from oil to gold to a lot of other commodities are coming up short. So we are seeing very much a very deleveraging or a backwards incentive to the one that has been in effect for the last several years, where people were playing with easy, you know, funny money from the U.S. From U.S. dollars and speculating around the world. We're going to see the unwinding of that, and that's obviously going to have some knock-on effects. And I think we're already starting to see those effects right now.
One of the things that's interesting about this deflation, virtually no one talked about deflation this time a year ago. And right now it's a common subject, and we've had to learn about it a little since in the last 5 or 6 months. We've been called on to learn about deflation, what's it mean, and what are the consequences. And the reason is because we see evidence of deflation in the U.S. dollar index, where the dollar has gone from in the 70s range on up to 92 today on the U.S. dollar index, something would have been just incomprehensible. 60, 90 days ago, it'd be hard to believe. And right now, there it is, and likely to go higher. Now, the U.S. dollar index is a measure of the dollar's purchasing power against 6 foreign currencies. So we can sit back and say there's evidence of deflation on the international level for the dollar. The dollar is gaining in value in the area of international trade relative to these 6 other countries and their currencies, which are losing value. But does that deflation that we see on the U.S. dollar index in the international markets, does that deflation, is that also affecting within the domestic economy of the United States? Are we seeing deflation here, or are we still, could we still be seeing some semblance of inflation domestically while we have deflation internationally? Does that make any sense? And if so,
the question does make sense, but I think it can't be answered by the official statistics that come out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics and other such places that clearly manipulate all of these types of stats. So I would ask yourself and those in the audience to think about their own daily shopping routines and whether they've seen any of this deflation in their own lives. I think probably one place that most people have seen it by this point is the falling oil price probably has knocked down the gas price.
Absolutely.
But has that knocked on to other products? I mean, are people seeing their grocery bills decreasing? I'm skeptical that that's the case, but perhaps you can tell me otherwise.
I can tell you that about a month ago, I wrote an article or at least talked about it on the radio program with Melody one time, pointed out, I said, it's mixed. We have some evidence of inflation, some evidence of deflation. I'm not going to believe we are in inflation in this country until I see my grocery bills begin to fall. And I've been watching. You could see it go up every couple of weeks. You go to the grocery store and you can see the prices higher than they were just a couple of weeks ago. That was true for perhaps a couple of years in this country. And then about a week or two ago, went to the grocery store and I had no subjective impression that the prices had gone up. And then we got a report that, in fact, food prices had dropped by 0.2% for the previous month. Now, that's not much, but on the other hand, I told Melody I'm not going to believe in deflation until I see the grocery bill go down. And it did go down just a shade, first time in a couple of years that I can recall. So maybe we are. Maybe deflation is catching on here in the country, and it is typically traditionally, it's one of the attributes or hallmarks of economic depression. Do you think
you're exactly right? Yes. Yes, because a lot of people have fixated on this idea of hyperinflationary depression or the Weimar Republic type of toilet paper printing press idea. But exactly right. I mean, depression, like the Great Depression, was essentially a deflationary depression. It was its contraction of the money supply that actually caused the carnage in the 1930s. So, I mean, it's not necessarily going to be happiness and rainbows just because it's the other way around. And then even besides that, you have some people who will still argue that, yes, we're going through a deflationary cycle now, but on the other end of that is a hyperinflationary cycle. So there's a lot of, unfortunately, doom and gloom, economically speaking, either way. It's not necessarily going to be a good thing. I mean, the ideal is to have the money supply growing at the exact ideal rate for the economy, and obviously that's not happening right now.
Well, when we get back, we're going to take a break for some commercials here in just a moment. But when we get back, here's a question for you. The hyperinflationary depressions we're talking about, do they only happen when we have a fiat currency, or have we ever had a hyperinflationary depression when we still had a gold or silver-based currency? We'll talk about that when I get back with my guest, James Corbett, from the Corbett Report. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back on Financial Survival.
pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival with our guest James Corbett from the Corbett Reports, CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, Report.com. We're talking, peculiar question, were there instances of hyperinflation associated with an economic depression before we got to a pure fiat currency?
Well, again, define pure fiat currency.
One that's not backed by anything other than just somebody's promise to pay. It can't be redeemed for anything tangible from the issuer. The government issues the currency or the Federal Reserve issues it. Somebody, it's like me writing a check. All right, and I write a check to you for $1,000. Well, that's just a promise to pay. If you send that to the bank and the bank says, sorry, Al doesn't have any money in the bank account, or by law, we've declared that you can't redeem it on the account that it was issued from, meaning the Federal Reserve or perhaps the federal government. To me, that's a fiat currency. You got to get it by finding somebody else and say, well, I can't get the government to redeem my piece of paper, but I know this guy down the street, he'll go for it. He's a dummy. I can give him this piece of paper and he'll give me his bass boat. All right? I can get a tangible payment by exchanging it with someone down the street. That make any sense?
Yes, I see what you're saying. Well, keeping all of that in mind, we should keep in mind that in the 1920s and 30s leading up to the Great Depression, of course, the world generally was not operating on a dollar reserve system. It was operating on a gold reserve system.
That's right.
That central banks kept gold as their means of settling exchange through the international system. So there was a gold standard. And of course, in America, that was a gold backing for the dollars that were being created at that time. There was still the chance to redeem currency in gold at the start of the Depression.
Yep.
So, yeah, no, I mean, there can be, I mean, even with a gold backing, there can be a depression cycle. But again, as we were saying, that was a deflationary depression cycle.
That's right.
In Weimar Germany, what you had was the hyperinflation that was caused by overprinting of the money. So,
had a fiat currency. They had hyperinflation with a fiat currency, but I'm wondering if anyone had hyperinflation when we had an asset-based currency that was backed by gold or silver.
Right. If there is an example of a hyperinflationary commodity currency, In history, I don't know of it. So, I mean, I'm willing to be proven wrong on that part.
No, I understand. Me too. I certainly don't know. But it raises another thing that I'm curious about. I'm certainly not, I don't have any significant education in economics. I'm merely a student. That's all I am at best. But I have something that bothers me. I see the money as fundamental, and the difference between a fiat currency and a currency that can be redeemed in gold or silver backed by some sort of a physical commodity, I see these as two different concepts that are so different, I wonder, do the same economic principles that were first suggested by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, when they had gold and silver for their money, do those same economic principles, supply and demand, for example, do they work today with a fiat currency the same way they worked with an asset-based currency when classical economics was discovered? To me, it's like having a formula for calculating numbers, and it's based on a square root. And when you have asset-based money, you have a positive number and you can find the square root. But when you have fiat currency, it's like having a negative number. And what's the square root of a negative number?
Yes. Well, I definitely see what you're saying here. I think my first response would be that the fundamental laws of the economy, like the fundamental laws of nature, you know, don't change. But the ways that we relate to them in different systems can be different. And as one, just as an approximation at an answer, because obviously I think I'd need more time to think about and develop a good answer to this question. But as one approximation to that answer.
Is that two for me?
No, one and a half.
I'm
going to give you half an answer here.
Okay.
But, I mean, we could think about Newtonian physics, calculating the laws of gravity, are good enough for horseshoes and hand grenades, as they say. I mean, they get the idea, but at most levels of what we do on a daily basis. But then Einstein comes along and 100 and whatever years later and says, well, actually, you know, in these cases, it's actually different, and it's actually a different law, but Newton's a pretty good approximation. And so, I mean, in the same way, you could say that perhaps laws of economic reality are in a similar manner. They're good enough for certain situations, but when you get into different situations, you find out it's actually somewhat different. I would say that fundamentally, my fundamental understanding of economy is that any money whatsoever comes down ultimately to the level of trust and faith and belief in a certain thing as a currency. I mean, again, what makes gold different other than, I mean, you mine it from the ground and there's only a certain set amount. But ultimately, if people don't value gold, if people don't have that faith in it as an exchangeable commodity, if people, for example, don't trust that it's not being, tungsten wrapped in gold plating or whatever, if people don't have the faith in that as an immediate exchange.
Right.
But if people have faith in that as a system, then it can continue.
I agree with you.
So now we're in this completely fiat system where obviously the U.S. dollar is whatever the U.S. government, or more accurately, the Fed decides it to be, and however much, you know, they want to expand the money supply or contract it, then we are in a completely manipulated reality where everything really just depends on what people perceive to be the truth. So if people perceive that the Fed is tightening now and or expanding or whatever they perceive, then they'll front run that and they'll bet against it or for it, or they'll get into these strange mind games where bad news for the economy actually means that people will bet more on the stock market because, you know, this means, oh, well, they're going to open up the floodgates and rain more money from the Fed. So you get that type of reality. But that reality fundamentally still is working on the same principles. It's just operating in a sort of different paradigm where everything is just what do you think the central bankers are going to do?
Well, we saw an example of that just recently where Janet Yellen came out and she said the word patience, and the market jumped up over 18, the Dow jumped up over 18,000. Now, what kind of a market do we have? What is the relationship between the market, the stock market, and reality if the chairman of the Federal Reserve can simply say one magic word and it jumps? What if she'd said impatience? Would it have collapsed by 1,000 points, or what would happen?
Yeah, if they'd raised rates, it may have. No, this is exactly the point. We live in a command and control economy to a certain extent. It's just to what extent does that take place? And obviously, when you have an economy that is so heavily dependent on the pronouncements of a single central banker, I mean, it absolutely is command and control. And I mean, let's just reflect on the fact that clearly, we live in a system that is really quite analogous in a lot of ways. In fact, in some ways, absolutely spot on with regards to the Communist Manifesto and the principles that were outlined in it. At the end of Chapter 2, Marx wrote the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto, a lot of which are taken place, are actually existing in the United States right now, including a heavy progressive or graduated income tax, abolition of all rights of inheritance, i.e. inheritance tax, right? Confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels. Well, we haven't gotten there yet, but, you know, I mean, I think that we could envision that.
Working on
centralization.
It.
Yeah, exactly, working on it. Centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and exclusive monopoly. Well, hello, Federal Reserve. I mean, so much of this has actually taken place that, that yes, it is a form of command and control economy, and it's just a question to what extent is America steeped in it at the moment.
And to what extent does it reflect the economy run by the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland? You know, there's a certain amount of communism and a certain amount of just tomfoolery in this thing, and hard to know where we're going about deflation. What do you predict in 2015? Will deflation continue? Will we see growing evidence of deflation? Or will the Federal Reserve essentially say we've got to have inflation no matter what, and we're going to step in here and do something to reverse the evidence of deflation?
I don't imagine that the Federal Reserve is going to step in to stem this tide. I think that whatever is going to happen is probably more likely going to be dictated by the periphery, i.e. the emerging markets, or more specifically the BRICS. I think if they did make some sort of ploy this year for whatever it may be, I mean, as we've talked about many times here, the death of a thousand paper cuts is going on, but if they did some sort of spectacular maneuver and actually did try to institute, I don't know, some sort of BRICS currency or some sort of gold backing to the yuan or the ruble or something of that nature, that would be a game changer. But other than that, I think that the tendency is for this deflation in the dollar, the strengthening of the dollar, to continue. I don't see anything that's going to knock the dollar off its horse unless there is some sort of combined effort like that on the periphery. But I don't see that coming this year because everything points to China trying to angle its way into the IMF special drawing rights basket. And I don't think they're going to do anything to upset that cart right now. And the Russian side of things is not going well. I'm about to write for the forecaster for this coming weekend about the Eurasian Economic Union, which you know, has officially arrived, but seems to be dead on arrival, or at any rate is pretty moribund and doesn't look like it's going to amount to very much anytime soon. So I don't see a significant competitor arising on the world stage this year, unless there is some sort of one of those spectacular announcements coming along down the pipe.
Well, the problem you have, my understanding of deflation is the principal problem is by making the dollar more valuable, you increase the burden on existing debtors and you make it more likely that they're going to default. And when they do, we wipe out the currency. We wipe out that portion of currency. The danger is in the deflation will help precipitate bankruptcies, and ultimately, once they get rolling, there's the danger. That's not just a danger to individuals, and it's not just a danger to companies. It seems to me that it is inevitably a danger to the biggest debtor nation in the world, the biggest debtor government in the world, and that's the United States. How are they? Will our national debt and whatever other obligations the government's assumed, will we be able to meet them during a time of deflation, or is the Federal Reserve and the government afraid and sitting back, oh my God, we've got to stop this? They're not able to pay their debts off with cheaper dollars. I mean, they were betting on that for most of my lifetime for inflation, and now all of a sudden they don't appear to have inflation. That's terrible for debtors everywhere in the world, or at least debtors in dollars.
Yeah, exactly. And you're exactly right about that. And that is a significant game changer. And that does affect the national debt, but not just the national debt. Consumer debt has been rising again after a brief pullback after the 2008 collapse. And of course, now we not only have a regrowth in the birth of subprime mortgages, if you can believe it, but also subprime car loans. Student debt is now at record levels, surpassing even credit card debt. There is a significant amount of debt by the American consumer out there right now, of course, denominated in dollars, which, as you say, is deflating, which is going to affect debtors. So absolutely, this is not a good thing. And when you put that on the back of the decline in oil prices, which, of course, play heavily into the derivatives market, which the banks have been speculating in, and the possibility of bank collapses and bank bail-ins, which are facilitated by the new rules drafted up and approved at the G20 at the end of last year. It's a perfect storm for a lot of bad things to be happening. And once again, let's just take a moment to reflect that all of this is happening in this realm of this extreme, what we know to be these manipulated markets of the Federal Reserve notes and everything that's backed up on them, which, again, is hundreds of trillions of dollars in notional derivatives and all of this craziness that the banks are playing with. So I think the answer to all of these problems for the average person is not going to come from within that system. It's not going to come from within the Federal Reserve note system as we've known it. So what is the answer? Again, I think there's a lot of different answers, but I mean, one of them, of course, gold has maintained its value for thousands of years and probably will do so in the event of the next hyperinflationary death of the next fiat currency, which has happened time and time again throughout history. But in terms of making actual exchanges with real people in our real lives every day, that is more likely than not going to be facilitated through community exchanges, alternative currencies, let systems, our systems, barter systems, exchange systems that more and more are popping up and being facilitated by some of these new technologies that make it easier than ever for people to interact in these kind of through these types of systems. And I think that ultimately is going to be, I mean, if we do see a catastrophic collapse, that is what people are going to rely on. It's what people relied on in the 1920s in Weimar Germany. They were trading and bartering directly with each other, more so than they were using gold to buy things from each other. So I think that's probably the best thing that we can be starting to get involved in. And it doesn't have to be everything, and it doesn't have to be, you know, the whole farm right away, but just starting to get involved with those things at the community level while we still can, while we still have the luxury of dabbling in it, is going to be, I think, really helpful in the long run, regardless of whether or not there is a collapse.
We're going to have to let it go. On that note, what you're going to need, folks, to get through the problem, if we're going to have a problem, is friends. Okay, you're not going to likely get through on your own. You're going to need friends who will help you. We're out of time. I want to thank James Corbett for being on the program again. I always have fun with talking to James. Always interesting and, for me, I don't know, fascinating. Thank you, James. Thank you for being here. Look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday. And in the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Frank the producer, Melody Cedarstrom. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got to be a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. Money, money, money.